My name is Rudy Edmond, and I'm a geologist, and I, by way of background, I teach still at California Lutheran University. I teach geology and offer a course that I call World Resources, in which we consider all kinds of world resources and the environment, and soil, and food, and things of that kind. So the topic that I've chosen for tonight is an expansion, really, of what we did last night in terms of forest ecology. I'd like to expand that now to think in terms of the topic of garbage and junk. Who cares? You know, and that's basically what I want to talk about. And this is my last session for the 24th year. And so you're liable to get the whole load. So just be prepared. So I want to say a few things to kind of orient our thinking. And then I'd like for us as a group to really discuss this, because we have some good resource people here, and David and Carl and Bob that were here with us last night, and others. And I've asked some of the theologians and some of the people to be on hand to keep us honest, you know. So we'll see what happens here before the evening is over. So let me begin by simply stating that the title I have chosen is obviously a very repulsive one, and one that you do not like to hear, and it grates on your ears to even think about garbage and junk, because you don't want to be associated with it. And this is pretty much the case of the church. They don't want to be associated with it either. And so that's why I think it's important that we start a dialogue and start talking about it. And I'd like to call your attention to two books that I think, you know, provide a major kind of background for considering this whole topic. One is called The State of the World, 1985. And this is a very good summary prepared by World Watch people, a World Watch Institute report. And this is the, they had a similar book a year ago, and it's an attempt to look at the total environment of the world on an annual basis and to update it from one year to the next, so as to tell us where we're doing a good job, where we're falling down, and what the problems are in relationship to our human environment, the environment of the human family. And so it's a very important kind of thing. And I have trouble finding theologians that are willing to tackle the first article. Everybody wants to stay with the second and third article and avoid saying anything about our responsibility for God's creation, which is the very vital thing for us if we're going to survive as a human family. But I find Joseph Sittler, Dr. Joseph Sittler, and this book is in the library. I happen to be a good friend of Dr. Sittler, and you know, I've been associated with him in different ways on the campus of California Lutheran College, and I know something of his thinking, and I recommend this book to you, and it'll startle you. Because he simply says what we're doing to our environment is just blasphemy of God's creation. You know, we are not dealing with it. And it's refreshing to have a man of Dr. Sittler's stature to stand up and say what he has said in this book. So, you know, if you read these two, then you're ready to put this into a form, into your Sunday school or into your church, and have a dialogue about the environment in which you live, and in your own area, and from the point of view of understanding the world. Because unless we do this, you know, we are in trouble. And I think to just start out to where I am, so that you know where I'm coming from. God is the creator and the provider of everything. He's also the sustainer of the environment in that sense, and the redeemer. So if you come at it from that point of view, then you look at as God the provider, and what are we? We are the crown of God's creation, and we're supposed to manage God's creation. We're the only animal capable of managing God's creation. And I submit we're not doing a very good job of it. And there's things that we need to be aware of. Now, I'm sure you realize at this point that we are now 5 billion people strong on the surface of the earth, all expecting to be fed and all expecting to have a good life. 5 billion people. Think about that. I think about it because when I was born, there were 2 billion people. I am now 76, and the figure now within this summer has moved to the point of 5 billion people. Now from 1910 to 1986, that's quite a jump. Now you can look, you see, at the next 50 years of your life and see where this is going to be, and also then begin to look at the environment that you're going to be living in 50 years from now, or 100 years from now, after I'm not around, but you'll be looking at it. And it's a very important kind of thing. We share one earth, and I think we have to deal with this. It's kind of easy to float off into the realm of science and technology and say, well, if we can't find it on Earth, we'll mine it from the moon, or we'll get it from Mars, or we'll go to Jupiter, or wherever it takes to get it, we're going to get it. But I think when it comes right down to it, we're born and we'll probably live, except for very few people, that will find any sustenance beyond our Earth. We share one Earth. And our population is going to keep right on going up. And the problems are that things that we require are not being increased. There is no more soil and arable land being formed. That, you know, that's not in the cards. That's not the way it's going to be. What's happening is we're encroaching on our resources and various kinds of things, and so the bottom line is that we're going to have less and more people and less kinds of things. So I just want us to be conscious of that, you see, as we look to the earth as a support system. We're now at the point where there is about one arable acre, I mean an acre that will raise a crop, where about one arable acre per person that lives on the planet. And as we encroach on this in terms of farmland and so on, that means that we cut this figure back. We're not going to expand it. It only can move back as we have more people to look at. And I submit at this point, and it's my own personal view, and I invite your challenge. I think we have a very arrogant point of view toward nature. We make the assumption that since we're the crown of creation, that we're to be provided for first, and that we are to be the people, we are to be the animals, in a sense, who are preferred in all of God's creation. Now, I submit that that may not be a proper way to look at nature. You know, when you look at nature that way, then you become very consumer-oriented. You say, well, if I'm capable of getting it, I'm going to get it. You know, and if I have the ability and the expertise to do it, I'm going to go for it. And so it becomes a very selfish kind of thing. And really, we have, I think, even in the church, emphasized the fact that the earth is worldly, you know, and it's something to be subdued. And now we are at the point in our development of science and technology when we have the tools to subdue the earth. And if we choose to do that, and if that's our attitude, then my point is we're capable of doing some real damage to God's creation. And I submit that as something to think about, you know. And I don't know how we're going to finally wind up with this. But science and technology have evolved to a point, you see, where we are really capable of doing very major kinds of things. We can handle high amounts of energy, and we know how to get at them. And everything from the atomic energy, you know, all the way through, we have really, in many ways, come to grips with this, to where we are using nature and not admitting that we're an integral part of God's natural plans. And we're playing God, in a sense, and that's what concerns me. As a scientist, I'm worried about this. And I'm worried about pollution, you see, in the sense that the more scientific, the more technological, the more tools we can create, the more waste we create. And so we're building up a backlog of garbage and junk every place we live that we really don't know what to do with. And we've got a good example of that right here in Holden Village. You know, we've got a real garbage problem. And what are we going to do about it? Well, it's no different here than it is down the road, down the valley. You go to any city, go to your city. And what's the problem? I live in the edge of Los Angeles. We're filling up big canyons with garbage and junk. And we're going to run out of canyons one of these days to fill over. You know, and we're only starting down the road of the next 1,000 or million years, you know, and I'm concerned about this at that point. And the more affluence we have, the more tools we have, the more things we want, and we want this, maybe rightly so, for all of the world. And there just aren't enough resources for everybody to have the kinds of things we have. We have a real problem because we are very rich in this country. We can produce so much food that we can't eat that it staggers your imagination. And so many of the people in the world are starving. And we can't possibly eat the food we can produce. we export, if we can finally find a place to send it, you know, up to 40 to 45% of everything that we raise. There's just no way we can consume it. And so, you know, this is a problem for us. And we have the third world, which for the most part has a malnutrition problem. And we have just the opposite. That's a concern. And I don't know what we're going to do about it, but I think we should be aware of it. And I think it is a major problem. And I think it is a problem that is not just for the scientists and not for the politician, but it is a problem for the church. If the church is not interested in God's creation and preserving it and taking care of it, caressing it, you know, loving it, being a part of it, then who is? Who's going to be concerned? And my question is, who cares? Really, and you come right down to it. I have to hope that the church cares about the first article, about God's creation, and about the gift that we've been given. And I have to hope, you know, that it becomes a part even of the program of Holden Village, which it basically is not. It is not a major emphasis here. The church, in my view, and then I'll keep quiet, I think must become much more worldly than it has in the past. And I think we have to think of the entire globe, the entire world, the entire entirety of God's creation. And it was created to bring glory to the Creator. And it's up to us to manage it in such a way that that happens. And so we're the only ones who can do it. We have to speak for all the animals and the plants that can't speak. You know, they have no voice. We have the voice, we have the power, and we have to exercise the judgment of what needs to be done. And so, with that kind of a provocative approach, which you don't want to hear, I know, but I invite your reaction.
One reaction, I think we've been lulled into complacency because the earth has an amazing ability to rebound. It's like a rubber band that'll stretch for a long way. A stream will purify itself when it runs over rocks, and you can put a little bit of pollutants into the water and it nourishes the water. Some garbage will rot, but when you put more pollutants into the water than it can take, then it becomes overloaded. And so I think nobody's responded because the earth is still, we're stretching that rubber band to the point where it can't stretch much more. And then we make synthetic materials like plastics. We were talking about that the other day. The earth can take wood waste and organic waste and dissolve it pretty quick. And it can clean streams pretty quick with running water just in its natural cycle of things. And it can clear the air. And it's done that up until now. But now we're starting to throw plastic in, and it takes a long time for plastic to dissolve, and then we're throwing in radioactive waste, which takes longer yet. So I think we're right to that point where now the waste that doesn't break down is starting to pile up. People have just been, well, it's always them, the scientists have taken care of it.
Right. Well, I just think it's to the point where it's too important a problem for the scientists to be charged with. This is not a science problem. You know, the bottom line is really feeding God's family, the human, and all of the other animals and plants. All the creatures are in the garden. They all need to be fed. And it's an attitude. It's not a kind of thing you just fix with money or technology or science. It's an attitude.
Just a comment on that attitude, I think, is caught up in all our consumerism. And just getting right back to the plastics that Carl mentioned, when you think of going to a fast food place, okay, everything is fast, fast, quick. Okay, from just getting food and running and getting back in your car or going through the drive-in. And then if you notice how much over-packaging is done with the plastics. Like if you get a Big Mac, it's put in a plastic container and then in a bag. And whoever told us we had to have it that way? But we bought into it.
Sure, the food lasts for a few hours or a day in our system, and the plastic container will last for 1,000 years.
Yeah, and it's just that whole consumerism mentality where someone has told us that we have to have this, and now we think we do, and we like all the packaging. That's just extra. I mean, it's kind of a joke in our house, but with straws, whoever said we had to use straws? To drink colas with. And, it's just an extra plastic.
Anyone who has ever packed for a long-distance camping trip knows exactly what Margaret is talking about, because if you go to the grocery store or to a food store of any kind and buy supplies to take on a long-distance backpacking or hiking or canoeing trip, and then you try to repack it into your backpack or duffel bag or whatever you're using for your long trek, you're going to realize that you save enormous amounts of space as well as substantial amounts of volume just by repackaging it in something that actually fits without all the extra layers, often which have very attractive colors and a very attractive labeling scheme, but really convey very little in terms of substance.
The other end of the trip is also interesting, Dave. When you look at, if you go out for zero impact camping and pay attention to what you bring back, you consume the food and you get the plastic and the junk that you're bringing back.
I think plastics were developed, though, to save the problem of using all the trees. But what's the answer? It's a vicious circle.
Yeah, and I was to use really, plastics are mainly petroleum-based. And of course, at the point where petroleum became a serious question, then we began to question that, whether it was a good decision to really go to plastics. But I think from an environmental point of view, the plastics really make no sense because they last too long. And if you can wash a cup and reuse it, rather than a plastic cup that you throw away that doesn't deteriorate. That's the problem.
We can grow more trees and make more paper forever. But we can't,
plastic. If we take care of the environment.
Maybe we don't need that much more paper, too. I think that's something we have to keep in mind. Yeah. Is that maybe we don't even need all the paper?
But it does rot and burn up easy.
Yeah. But I think we like Rudy said, it's the attitude. We've got to get away from that consumerism.
You see, I'm constantly on my soapbox here, inviting people to go into the environment to look for junk.
Is that a plastic soapbox?
There is. No, it isn't. But, when you get into the environment of the wilderness, there is no junk in God's creation. There is absolutely no junk in the wilderness. Everything is reused, used, reused, every animal, every plant. There is nothing that goes to waste. Now that's the kind of an environment we were born into. That's the kind of a gift we have in creation. We have deviated a long, long way from that. And if you go back and look what we're using in the last 100 years compared with what we used as a family, a human family, in the preceding million years. I mean a million years. You see, the human family has been on Earth for well over 3 million years. And it's only been in the last 50, 100, 200 years that we really have seriously abused the environment. I was born on a farm in southeast Iowa. And believe me, as a family, soil was extremely important. And when it came to considering whether you cashed out a crop or whether you turned it to make for better soil for the next year's crop, there was no question. My dad just felt you got to take care of the land. And I was born and raised with that kind of an environment. Our children today are not in that environment. Back in 1910, the Dark Ages, you see, then most of the people of this country were rural. And they had a direct connection with the land, a very high percentage of them. Now, the whole demography has changed. Most of the people are in the cities. And most of them think milk comes out of a plastic container. It's a whole new ballgame.
How do European countries compare with the United States?
Pardon?
How do the European countries compare with the United States?
Well, European is better, but the third world countries are the ones that really have to look to the earth for survival. When you go to a third world country, there they know if they do not raise enough crop this year, they will not be alive next year. And so it's a survival kind of economy where they must take care to see that the earth produces something for them. We don't have to do that because we have so much affluence and so much excess that we don't even think about it.
Except that we're also exporting our ideas of consumerism and our lifestyle to the point where the third world countries are depleting the tropical rainforests.
Mm-hmm. Right.
For that carrot right in front of them, and are ruining the land. And by exporting this consumerism we have and this lifestyle that we have in the third world, they continue at the rate they're going, the world's tropical rainforest will be depleted in 50 years. And there was our energy.
Talking about garbage, I know that in Papua New Guinea, where the people used to be able to throw away their coconut husks or whatever they had,
yeah.
and had no system of having to deal with debris because it was taken care of naturally. Today, you walk into the villages and they just have tin cans lying around. I don't know what it will look like in 20 years because they just don't have a system of even disposing of those
non-biodegradable kinds of things.
It's just,
you know, we're just filling the environment.
The rivers are just all junky, much worse than we have it. And of course, they aren't even conscious of the problem, but they have all our things, our Coke bottles and beer cans.
Yep, we have exported all of this, you know, and tried to teach them how to do all of this, and then they wind up with all of this junk. And what are they going to do with it? We don't help them solve that part of the problem. We're interested in selling them product.
Now, one aspect of this whole subject, which is very superficial compared to what you're talking about, is the matter of aesthetics and the matter of littering. And we are a littering people all the time, and wherever you go, there's junk scattered all over the place, and I think it's an evidence of the lack of reverence that we have for creation again. And if you love creation, I think it goes against our grain to go out in nature and find all this junk from our civilization scattered around.
Well, that was my point about arrogance. You know, I just think we treat God's creation very arrogantly.
I agree 100% with what you're saying. I sometimes have some difficulties with us not going beyond changing our attitudes and getting into some real specific practical things about changing our behaviors. I guess one of the concerns I have is I see the village here as somewhat of a isolated system. And we're bringing stuff up the valley to feed people and to sell in the stores, and everybody coming in here is bringing goods with them and depositing the garbage here, and it's not going out of here. And in a sense, we're sort of like a self-contained city beginning to build up its own garbage. And if you've been up to the warehouse and looked at some of the accumulations of garbage and some of the stuff we're starting to build, we're developing our own problem at the village here. And I guess what I'm wondering is, what are some specific kinds of things that we as Holden can start changing and doing with our own garbage problem in order to model some specific things that people can go home and use at home?
Are we doing that with the garbologist? I mean, we do sort and burn and, you know, compost. I mean, we are sort of a model. We're doing more than a lot of places and cities are doing.
But, you know, are we teaching people that, or are we just saying that's how we do it here and not explaining it and demonstrating why? And
we need to have garbology walks.
You know, yeah. Just a comment on that. When I've been here before in the summer, the garbage dock was like a loading dock. Now it's being developed outside of the village and the bridge there. And to me, I'm not as aware of the garbage and the whole process. And there was something really good about having it on the loading dock. And I think it's really nice that that loading dock is freed up now. But it was right there, and you could see the process going on. And I felt like I was in the
bathroom. Okay, anybody else?
Well, actually, in years past, there has been some sharing of the experience of the composting and all that. Last year or so, we haven't had much attention to that. We just had a talk about the best way to make a compost heap and things like that. I don't really know when I understand, but the talks were there.
Right. You see, for a number of years here, we had a pretty strong emphasis on this. And we had a science and technology committee that met regularly. And we were always in contact with one another. And we raised these concerns with the village. People here that were very much interested, and people that began to do things about it. This has kind of dropped through the cracks now. We aren't that much interested at this point. If we are, we aren't doing anything about it.
Well, I think that's sort of indicative of our society, too, where it really in American political life, I think we've gone backwards. The sort of, you know, James Watt and everything under the Reagan administration, we've gone backwards in terms of tax credits for energy conservation and environmental policy. That's sort of a side there. I mean, I think it really is happening everywhere. And probably the cheap oil was the worst possible thing that could have happened to us these last 2 years, because once again, we're driving more miles and building more inefficient cars. It's unfortunate. I think that, yeah, I'd like to talk about some practical possibilities that we can do, not just at Holden, but out in our congregations too, because I think it is a question of behavior. We see the problem, we know that it's an offense to God's creation and an offense to the first article of the creed, like you cited. And then how much are we willing to modify our behavior? Are congregations willing to start recycling programs, for example, or even to encourage participation in the city recycling programs that are in most of our cities now? Participation is really low. I know my own congregation in Minneapolis had a newspaper recycling program, but we didn't do cans and bottles. It's really hard to get enough staff to be willing to do cans and bottles, but I think it's those kinds of things, as as consumers that we really need to talk about. Are we willing to share appliances within our congregation, to share cars or share lawnmowers or washing machines or drive less? And that it is sort of a faith question here, how obedient to God's, what kind of stewards of creation are we willing to be, and what kinds of changes in our own behavior are we willing to make?
When I was in Spokane, I became involved with Gonzaga University's Environmental Law Caucus. And one of the things that the Law Caucus did to raise money was to recycle things from around the law school and from around the university. And so we recycled not only paper, but also glass and tin and a couple of other materials, all of that collected just from the campus. And the Environmental Law Caucus was able to gain enough money from that to run a fairly decent program with a number of speakers and films and other things during the year. And all of that was paid for just out of this recycling operation. And it didn't take any extra, it didn't cost us anything. It returned money, which helped out all the way around. And it was a fairly steady and regular flow of income every month. It wasn't particularly difficult to do. It was just a matter of taking the time and the effort to set up the process initially, and then make sure that everyone around knew what we were doing. But I doubt that there's a congregation or a school group or any other kind of group that couldn't use a fairly steady income for some sort of social purpose or program purpose or other kinds of activities like that. And all it takes is one or two people to have the idea that that's a good way of raising money. And my guess is that for most congregations or for most social groups, that they could raise more money that way than with many of the bake sales or garage sales or some of the other things that they might come up with, and which might happen once a year, but which don't actually have this continuing recycling aspect to them.
Or how many congregations are willing to start using regular cups at their coffee hour instead of styrofoam cups? My congregation, we recycle newspapers, but we use styrofoam cups. But it really is an inconvenience, and that's the whole question there on what we're willing to do. How many people are willing to lobby for a bottle or can bill in their state? My state doesn't have one. Minnesota can't seem to get one passed. But are we as churches willing to take stands on that to get those kinds of things passed?
Just one comment on Barb's comment about styrofoam cups. We did that in my congregation where, just research Bible study, just everyone brought their own bottle. And, all it was a suggestion. I mean, people, well, I forgot at first, but as more people started doing that, they did. And maybe not only did we save maybe 10 styrofoam cups that time, but consciousness level was raised. And I think that's important. Or just, volunteering to wash the cups after a meeting, a committee meeting, maybe 15 cups or 10 cups or whatever. And again, the consciousness level is raised. And what it is it just makes people stop and say, how much of a hurry are we in? We can wash the cups, take 10 minutes, and that's that. I think, it's one person making the comment. And it's amazing, how much change that could bring about. And I think that's a very, very simple thing that each one of us could do in our
On that one, I wish I had more information, because I've taken that on in our congregation and pushed for it a bit, and I get answers back that when you fire up the dishwasher, you use a lot of oil and you use soap, and so they claim, the argument back is that it's environmentally a tit for tat, it's not worth the effort. So I need some good evidence to say that they're wrong.
You wash them without the dishwasher?
Yeah, you're taking your cups home is the best. I like that.
Yeah, it was kind of fun to just, because then not only do you raise that consciousness, but that idea of individuality instead of everyone having the same start and cup. You saw people's taste were, and there was something creative about it.
Yeah.
course, I dropped my mug and broke it. That was my favorite one.
But I often find that I don't have as much information as I want. For example, on the McDonald's thing, I wrote President McDonald's Corporation about it. I said, I'm not going to buy your pride anymore when you use all that styrofoam. I got a very articulate answer back that claimed that paper products are sprayed with a certain kind of material that is just as unbiodegradable as the styrofoam, and claimed that styrofoam is better. I mean, he says ecologically it's a better product. Well, that was their claim. Now, he may be wrong, but I didn't have any way of combating it.
That was great that you wrote a letter. Thanks for doing
it. I think that's the place where we need to wrestle with what specific things can we do.
Yeah.
And I really believe that economic sanctions happen at the fast food counter. They happen at the grocery store. When you go to buy your milk and choose to buy it in the wax-coated carton versus the plastic container. Or when you do go to McDonald's, you tell them, I'll take it on a napkin. You can keep your bag and your styrofoam stuff.
You know, I maintain, right or wrong, that every time you spend a dollar, you are in effect voting for what you want. Now, if you just take that literally and just think about it, you know, if you're willing to buy it, somebody is willing to make it. And they're willing to sell it to you at a profit. And that's the way it is. It all starts with your spending. And if you will not buy it, they won't make it. It's just that simple. That's very American. But it is an attitude that we're not buying into at this point. We're really buying into the consumer end rather than the conservation end. And I maintain that the church, if the church is not interested in conservation and really taking care of God's resources, who is? Who should be? Certainly you can't expect the scientists or the technologists or the politicians. They're gonna give you what you want, and you're finally in control. And it becomes an attitude that the church, if it doesn't get behind it, you know, we can't blame anybody.
Rudy, are you suggesting instead of the coffee, the Cokes that we buy, we drink water from the fountain, eliminating the plastic cup, and even the need to wash the mug, you know? But
I'm not trying to advocate anything in particular. I really am interested in our attitude toward all of this. And I think that we have come to the point where we had better think about what we're doing to the environment. Now, we see it right here in the village, and we have a wonderful opportunity when we're here, you know, to see something that isn't polluted. And let it soak in. Go out on the trail, get away from the trail, far enough, and see how it functions. All of these things are interwoven, and environmentally you can't do one thing. It's going to touch something else. And so everything is tied together in God's created world. And we have to be very careful with how we're treating things. I'm sure that nature was made for our use, but it's also made for the use of every plant and animal that lives on the surface of the earth. And unless we take the attitude that we are a part of nature, a part of God's creation, rather than we are here to control it, and to monitor it, and to subdue it, and to make it serve our wants, not our needs always, but even what we want. That's the point. And I really think that we need to be serious about it.
I think one objection that has been raised sometimes to having things environmentally sound and clean has been typified perhaps by an example that comes out of New York State and the efforts to clean up the Hudson River. Well, as you know, probably the Hudson River was very dirty, and a number of attempts were launched to clean up the river, make it cleaner for the various species of fish that swam in the river, the wildlife that was along the upper Hudson and so forth. And one of the objections was raised, well, we don't really care about what happens to the fish. What happens to the fish doesn't affect us here in New York City. And of course, the point of cleaning up the water is not only that it is more healthful for the fish and the wildlife, but if it's dirty, it's also damaging to people. And of course, there is ample evidence now of the ways in which that kind of polluted water can be damaging to people as well as to the fish and the wildlife and the other kinds of things that are all sustained by a continually flowing river. And I think it typifies perhaps the way in which we have tended to objectify nature, regarding, you know, nature as a species of fish which is somehow alienated from us. We can, you know, poison the fish and somehow it doesn't touch or affect us if we poison something. Just as long as it's not human, it's okay. But somehow we have removed ourselves from that chain of being, that chain of life, and said that, you know, if it poisons the fish, it's not going to poison me, it's not going to hurt me, or it's not going to hurt any of the things that people do. And that just isn't true. There's ample evidence now that what is damaging to the fish damages the fishermen and the fisheries and the other sorts of sea creatures. It damages many of the structures that are along rivers. Just to name a few instances of the ways in which this damage can sort of radiate from the initial source.
Do you see zero population growth, EPG, as part of the solution to the problem?
Do I see how?
Zero population growth. Because we're not producing so much of our own food anymore. We're terribly dependent on others to produce the food for us. Mm-hmm. Of those 5 billion people, we're concerned about the fact that too many of those 5 billion will handle those tomatoes before we get to them in the supermarket, instead of them being individually parceled, which keeps human hands off them. Seemingly, controlling population could be part of the problem from a worldwide perspective.
Yeah, I see we have, through our technology, we have encouraged the growth of population. See, we have exported medicine and ways of keeping the young child from dying and the old person alive. And so we have exported this to the world. And they have naturally bought into this. And so the population goes up. It's a side product from our affluence and technology. And we, you know, have not thought about the cost. But there is a cost, you know. And if we're going to have better medicine in this country, there's no reason why the rest of the world shouldn't have it. And that makes good sense. But if that's going to be the case, then do we need to also export the concept that we can't have too many people on the earth, in the sense that there should be some population control? Now, this is not the philosophy of the third world in any sense. That is, the only security people have in the third world is to have enough progeny that when they get old, somebody is going to be there to take care of it. And they're accustomed to the fact that most of the young normally die before they get to the point that they can provide security for the elderly. We have a whole new world to rethink, you see, in this kind of a concept. And it's new to them. And they don't necessarily buy our model. And I'm not sure that the world can afford our model. That's the serious thing about it. The world can't afford the affluence of the American people. We're just too rich.
How does Holcomb take care of its garbage? What do you burn and what do you bury? What do you do with a little bit of plastic you might have?
Well, well, we burn the paper and bury the plastics.
Why can't you burn the plastic?
Well, I don't know.
Does EPA say you can't?
It pollutes the atmosphere. It's very toxic in the sense that you introduce it into the air. It's not made to be burnt.
A lot of it would just melt under normal fire. It won't burn. It won't burn. Higher temperatures than we normally produce.
So it still has stuff.
Yeah, but even the chemical that...
The chemicals, yeah.
You pollute the air. You only transfer the product for the other area.
Right, you transfer it to the atmosphere. And we have enough trouble with keeping the atmosphere cleaned up.
This one is probably more for staff, but I've thought about it as I've been bringing up pop cans to hold. That actually, this is the one place where it's to throw things away is free. We're not like in Seattle. I know you pay your garbage bill by the number of cans you have. But here at Holden, you can produce as much garbage as you want. It doesn't cost you anything. Maybe we should start in a little way to charge each person who wants to throw a pop can away. You call it pop out here? What do you call it out here? Soda can away or whatever. Or a beer can or a wine bottle. Charge them, I don't know, a nickel a piece per can or something. Same thing with disposable diapers. Well, those burn, so that wouldn't be a problem. But although they're very ecologically wasteful, but start charging people money for the amount of garbage that they dump here and see what happens then.
What would happen if we encourage people to carry out everything that they bring in, just like we do when we go to the wilderness? If you're going to bring it to Holden Lake and use whatever you're going to use, consume what you can, but bring the rest of it back. Well, we ought to bring it all the way back to someplace else. That's the problem.
In Seattle's garbage.
And finally, you know, what are we going to do with all the garbage and all the junk and all the cars? What's going to happen to your car? Where is it going to wind up? And your electric razor? And everything else that you have.
What do you do with scrap food? Yeah.
What are we going to finally do with it? we're a very young human family. Hopefully, we have thousands of years to live out as a family. And when are we going to start thinking about how we're going? How the habitat, what the environment's going to be like for our children and their children, on down 1,000 years. The human family is 3.5 million years old. We've come this far. Let's not goof it up.
Just
One brief comment along those lines. Since I've been here, just about every day, somebody asks about the tailings and mining the tailings. Yet almost every city in the country could mine its own garbage dump for many of the same materials. And all of those garbage dumps are a resource for the present and the future.
Well, thank you all for coming, and I'd like, you know, a finding parting shot, you know, take a look at this book. Original blessing. Creation was a blessing. And think about it. You know, by Matthew Fox. It's a good book. Thank you.